Nationalized the banks, stupid us, we nationalized the banks and left them in the hands of the bankers. We must be the only country in the world that nationalizes something and leaves it in the hands of the capitalists. My name's Elaine Bernard. I'm the director of the Labor and Work Life Program at Harvard Law School. And I was asked to speak as part of the Howard Zinn lecture series. Howard Zinn was a good friend of mine, as I'm sure he was for many of you. And I know Howard would just love this movement. Howard would see it as a new chapter in his people's history of the United States of America. He'd love the fact that people took direct action to bring attention to a very important issue, and that the attention, a small group of people, created a catalyst that then moved hundreds, that then moved thousands, that have moved millions around the world. Howard Zinn would very much approve of, and in fact, he'd be down here if Howard was alive. Howard's not alive, but his spirit certainly is alive here in Occupy Boston. Now, what I wanted to talk to you today about was a talk I've been doing around the country called From Heroes to Zeros. How we ended up in this crazy situation when in 10 short years we've gone from a moment where we viewed public employees, and in particular uniformed services public employees, as heroes, people we looked to when there was a crisis in the bombing of the World Trade Center. These were the folks who were running into the building, every one of them a public employee, when others were running out. So how in a 10-year period do we move from seeing essential public servants as heroes to now acting as if they are at fault for the financial and economic crisis we're in today? How did this happen? Well, I think a big part of it has been how first we're into this great recession. I don't know what's so great about it, but this great recession that was brought to us by the almost complete collapse of the financial sector. But more important, it was brought to us by over 20 years of totally failed economic policies of privatization, deregulation, and free trade. In this crisis, the banks were rescued, but not the American worker. And in fact, it was used as an opportunity to aim at one of the most vital and important instruments of workers in a democracy, that is, trade unions. But how did it come to blame public employee unions in particular? Well, again, it's the example of how a crisis provides a moment for opportunity, a political opportunity, but it was not used by progressive folks. Instead, it was used by some fairly conservative attack the labor movement. Now, what we saw was, first, the labor movement in America now is very, very small. Less than 7% of the workforce in the private sector is unionized, as opposed to over a third of the public sector. One of the reasons for that is that, frankly, there are better labor laws until recently in some of the public sector. The law of our country with regards to labor is really 19th century at best, probably 19th century. You see, the rule of the workplace is that you have no rights. You have no rights in the workplace. And what are unions? Well, unions are vehicles for acquiring rights. And getting rights isn't the same as being able to exercise them. So unions allow folks to first organize to gain rights, that's what a collective bargaining agreement is, and then they're a vehicle for exercising rights. Well, what is the right of an American worker in the private sector? Well, they have the right to quit. It's called the doctrine of employment at will. You can't be fired for a very narrow group of discriminatory reasons. You can't be fired explicitly for being female. You can't be fired explicitly for being black. You can't be fired explicitly for being disabled or for being elderly. But you can be all of those things or none of those things. And as long as you're very carefully fired for no reason, that's the law. Now, you might think that's maybe not a very good regime. It was a step forward from slavery, where you couldn't quit, or indentured servitude, where you couldn't quit. So the doctrine of employment at will was that you were allowed to quit. That may have been reasonable law for the 19th century, but for the 21st century, it places us with totalitarian regimes as far as any sense of rights of working people in the workplace. So how do working people gain rights in the workplace? They gain rights by organizing, and that's what unions do. They are vehicles for winning rights, vehicles for exercising rights, and you know what? They do something else. They help folks in the workplace understand that they have a right, hell, even a responsibility, to participate in decisions that affect them. Now, economists talk about that. They talk about the difference between voice and exit. Exit is when you see a problem, you leave. Oh, I don't like this workplace, it's not very good, I'll quit. That's exit. Imagine a society where everybody simply exit, as opposed to rolling up your sleeves and saying, this isn't working very well, let's join with other people and change it. That's voice. And what a union introduces into the workplace is this notion of voice. By bringing people together, by forming an organization where people argue and work out ideas, where they protect workers so that they can give critical feedback loop from the front line of where goods, services, and caretaking is actually taking place and help change systems, they play a vital role. And as a democracy, they also remind people, democracy isn't every two years for just a couple of minutes when you mark a ballot. Democracy is far more robust than that. Democracy is the right to participate in decisions that affect you, and more of those decisions happen in the workplace. So a union increases the likelihood and provides a vehicle for workers to do that. And so, as such, that's why unions aren't just about their members. They're in fact a vital instrument of any democracy. And it's why they have a value beyond their own members. And what we've seen in the United States is an ongoing campaign to destroy, to decertify, to undermine, and to eliminate unions. And unions come from the notion of... Well, we seem to... I can keep yelling. I'm just going to... Okay. So how did we end up coming to focus on the attacks on the public sector unions? Well, it's very, very simple. With private sector unions now down to only 7% of the workforce, 7% density, sorry, and public employees now the largest grouping of unionized employees, basically, going after public employees is a way of going after the labor movement as a whole and breaking forever, they hope, the labor movement. But of course, it's not working. What we've seen is that instead, we see an awakening in the public sector and amongst private sector unions, and an understanding that these vital institutions are very important to our democracy. But also, it's an attack against government and the whole notion of political, the whole notion of public governance. You know, we saw this over the last 20 years. We started to hear things like, you know, the public sector, public goods, they just spend money, they cost money. Only the private sector creates wealth. And we see the way the private sector has destroyed wealth in this country. But public sector is actually a wealth-producing entity. It just produces a different type of wealth. It's the type of wealth that we hold in common. Clean water, safe streets, all of the public goods, fresh air, all of these things are public goods. They don't become valuable only when you privatize them. And in fact, that's just transferring wealth that we own in common, called commonwealth, into private hands, called the private sector. Well, the transfer of wealth without compensation has had a word to describe it. It's called theft, not wealth creation. So the notion of a public sector, a public sector that provides goods and services and regulation within which private wealth as well as public wealth is created, has always been a part of our society. What we see today is the attempt to further privatize and, in fact, to remove and eliminate the public sector. And with it, we need to see what it is. It's the theft of public value, moving from the commonwealth to rapidly becoming solely the private wealth. So the attack on public employees is really also an attack on the public sector. It is an attack on democracy, and it is an attack on some of the final, the remnants of what holds us together as a society, which is, in fact, this notion of a commonwealth. So part of the fight back against the concentration of wealth, concentration of power, is to have democracy flourish. And one of the key ways for democracy to be reborn is by people organizing. People organizing here in protest, the 99% against the 1%, but also people organizing in the workplace to form organizations such as unions that can talk about and influence and make democracy a daily occurrence instead of something that happens only every couple of years. Unions are the premier institution of civil society. They breathe life into a democracy by reminding folks in the workplace and giving a voice to people in the workplace. And that's the basis of a democracy, which is why, interestingly enough, in our international policy in the United States, we promote unions. We think unions are a good thing for other countries, just not for this country. So one of the things we learned in the labor movement many years ago, the best way to predict the future is to create it. And it's through organizing, whether it's union organizing, whether it's community organizing, whether it's citizen organizing, whether it's immigrant organizing. One of the ways to change the future is by organizing and taking it into our own hands. Thank you.
Thank you.
This concept of worker, we see it. So as soon as somebody says worker, you go, oh my gosh, Marxism. But then, I mean, scientists are workers. Teachers are workers. I mean, it goes the whole spectrum. You know, if you don't own the system, you're working. You know.
Yeah. The question was, how can we expand the notion of worker, or maybe the recognition of common interests amongst folks who have to sell their ability to work and that really aren't great owners of capital. It is sort of funny. You folks here are being accused of provoking class warfare. How come when 99%, you know, are left out and 1% owns the vast majority of wealth, that the 99% are accused of provoking class warfare? I mean, the most conscious class in America is the wealthy class, is the ruling class. And one of the more interesting things is their ability to convince everybody else that, you know, there are no classes. Billionaires and homeless folks, we're all in one boat together. It's just complete utter nonsense. So it starts with some recognition of what your position is. We seem to be on a timer here. Okay?
Yeah.
One way of thinking of it is what's happening right now. Did you know that 1 in 4 mortgages in America right now is underwater? That means more money is owed than the value of a house or asset. That's an improvement because in 2009 it was 1 in 3 was underwater. That tells us that people who think they have a lot of wealth, and I think nowadays most workers are catching on, what is their form of wealth? Their form of wealth is their pension and maybe a home. That's the two ways that the vast majority, even middle-class Americans, accumulate wealth. Well, one of the things that's happened over the last 20 years is much of it's disappeared. So starting to realize that, think of yourself without a job. How long can you survive without a job? So you might have a car, you might have a home, but one of the things we've been discovering in this great recession is how quickly those things can disappear. And historically, folks, one of the reasons we have things like insurance, one of the things why we tend to have, in most countries, universal programs is to try and remove individual risk and to sort of band together. You can't have a society with great winners unless you've got great losers. And so some of... the civil rights movement and I never would have joined it, right? Everybody say, oh man, I wanted to be there. I wanted to be there with Martin Luther King, right? And they always want to be there with the last social movement after it's won. Yeah. But anybody who's been there at great social movements when they started out, remember, they're tiny little movements. Yeah. And you know what? Every great social movement started off by being baited as a bunch of freaks and weirdos, and you don't represent the minority, and you're not normal, and you stick out.
Lazy bums,
you name it, I'll keep it clean. And yet, after it wins, after it takes off, then all of a sudden everybody was there at the beginning. You sort of wonder why you ever need to have a social movement when it seems that everybody after it won seems to have been a member of it. Actually, when I look around here, I keep thinking of, you know, there is a history of occupations and those types of movements in America. Because I work with and I'm part of, and I think about the labor movement. There's a lot of folks in labor, older folks, who would be looking around and saying, you know, the American labor movement, the private sector unions that I talked about earlier, a lot of them came out of the 1930s, and they came out of what was protests and eventually even occupations. And it wasn't just occupations of city squares, it was occupations of the factories. And what's also important is that they don't always start right away. So I've been going around the country for 3 years talking about the crisis that we're in. And it's really interesting that this great recession started in 2008, but now it's 2011 and we finally see a reaction. We finally see some protest. But if you think about the social movement that started up during, if you think about the social movements that led to the rise of the Congress of Industrial Organizations and the labor movement, the Great Depression starts in 29. You don't see it in 1930. You don't even see it in 1931. It's not until 33, 34 that you start to see the development of a great labor movement and great protests. So the fact that it's taken a few years to get started is not surprising. But the issue is, will it be transformative? Is this the nucleus, the small beginning of what could be a transformative social movement? I would argue it must be. It must be because we're in a transformative moment. If you look at this recession, it is different than the recession of the 1980s. It is different than previous recessions. Previous recessions, we go down, we lose, we have unemployment, we have a decline in the gross domestic product, we go down, and within a year or two, we come back. Within a couple of years, the employment's, you know, caught up, and we're moving again into a growth cycle. You'll notice that in this recession of 2008, one of the reasons it's now called the Great Recession is because we have unprecedented levels of not only unemployment, but for longer, deeper, and with little prospect of much of a real... Yeah, 6 years. Yeah. Well, let me tell you, it can be 6 years, it can be 10 years, or it can be no years. It's really up to us. It's in our hands whether or not we tolerate this. This is something that we choose to tolerate or not tolerate. And the difference is organizing, whether we organize. And organizing is taking what we have, and what we have is ourselves, our time, our commitment, to get what we need to win what we want. And I think this has had, even as a small movement, a movement that has been criticized, has had a profound effect on much larger institutions. It's all of a sudden brought to the attention the anger that is out there. The anger you represent isn't the minority, it is in fact the vast majority of Americans. Thank you.
Oh, Noel Ignatieff.
Just a quick announcement. The next speaker for the Howard Zinn Lecture Series is going to be Noel Ignatieff.
At November 12th at 5 o'clock.
It's going to be on November 12th at 5 o'clock right here.
Title is Race and Occupy.
The title of his talk is going to be Race and Occupy.
Good.